Welcome back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because the world's so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery and people getting whacked whenever they expose some other form of scumbag, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Speaking of which, learning about the New World Order and the assassinations of decent people and so on and so forth, umpteen millions of conspiracies that are probably out there that we just haven't even discovered yet, I found myself questioning my sanity somewhat and think to myself, oh my God, is this real? Or is this just some kind of a made-up matrix designed to make me go frickin' nuts? And the unfortunate thing is, it's real. And it really does drive some people crazy. And the only way to really maintain one's sanity, I found, is to maintain some levity. What does it do? It provides relief in the face of certain death, basically. Tony Farrell is my very special guest. Welcome back.
Thank you, Vinny.
Any thoughts on what I've just said there?
Yeah, I think putting in trying to have a sense of humour about this and actually presenting things in a more light-hearted light has an opportunity to win the hearts and minds of people that would otherwise be turned off and be so appalled by all of this that they can't even look at it. Miss Seven's case, for instance, is interesting because, and then one of the reasons why I stuck with it is because the stolen concepts concerned things that the British public, by and large, the ones that are tuned into the plug-in drug, the BBC television programmes on a Saturday evening, their beloved Strictly Come Dancing, if they ever thought, for instance, that that had been stolen from a victimised individual who's been gang-stalked for a decade in the process to keep it all hush-hush, they'd be appalled by that. Whereas, on the contrary, we can't wake them up on the horrors of 7-7, but it might have been committed by the state apparatus. So I'm hoping that, in a back-to-front way, we can use this case to actually wake up some of the masses that would be utterly appalled by the thought that their beloved TV programme has been stolen. And the second thing is, I'd add to your injection of humour and all of this, it's fantastic to talk with somebody so articulate as you are, Vinny, but I would add one thing that's personal to me, which is my complete faith in all of this. And I just want to, if I may, Vinny, can I just tell you a little bit of story in connection with Seven?
Well, we have a whole hour, so go for your life.
Well, I mentioned in the last half that two individuals that were very supportive of Miss Seven were whacked on the same day, which was the 17th of May 2012. That was the very day I made my second contact. I met her for the first time on May Day 2012, exchanged telephone numbers, and I happened to be... This is the story. On the 17th of May... you've interviewed this gentleman. It's called Mo Adib. You've had him on your show, and he's the maker of Ripple Effect 2 and Ripple Effect, the Nazi Banksters, and I'd thoroughly recommend those programs to be searched by, and it's jforjustice.net.
Now, I got in contact with Mo Adib, and he allowed me to upload those videos to my channel as well. So if you click on the YouTube little thing on my website, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, you can go there and search Mo Adib or 7-7, and it should come up with it.
Right. Well, what happened is that just before Mo Adib completed his Ripple Effect 2 film, he was desperate to get a photograph of my boss, a DCI Steve Williams, who was down on the terror drill on the London bombings on that day. And he admitted that on the fifth anniversary. Now, this was when there was a terror drill exercise with highly improbable coincidences that morphed into the real thing. So he clearly knew something that he wasn't prepared to let on. So in an effort to expose him, Mo Adib had instructed me from a base in Sheffield, like South Yorkshire, to get a photograph so it could feature in the film. So for the best part of the day, I camped out in the bushes overlooking the professional standards unit of South Yorkshire Police until 7 p.m. in the evening, by which time the battery on my phone was exhausted, and therefore, and he was the last person still in the car park and never came out. So I failed to get DCI Steve Williams, but just before the battery went, I got a phone call out of the blue from Miss Seven. And she then, we made contact. And then when I went down to London to see about and look at all her case files, she told me the story about one of these two, well, about both these two gentlemen that died on that same day that she tried to make contact. And she told me an incredible story that had similar coincidences. And I'm going to share that story now, if I may. At the final hearing, when it got closed down in front of the corrupt judge, Lord Justice Lawrence Collins, Miss Seven, armed with a team of 24 supporters in the court, or two dozen or so supporters in the courtroom, when she was witnessing Lord Justice Lawrence Collins corruptly closing the case down without enabling her to have any reference to Judge Pumphrey's earlier hearing, which she won, and he dismissed the case without merit, she watched behind the judge's head at the back of the courtroom walls, and this is how she described it to me, that she saw, coming through the walls in Reading, the words "Mene, Mene, Tekel Upasin" appear. And she was astounded. With her was one of these two gentlemen that died, who was a Christian pastor. And they were able to, afterwards, to explain what that meant. And it, if you've ever heard of the expression, the writing on the wall, "Mene, Mene, Tekel Upasin" comes from Daniel 5 in the Bible, which is all about Belshazzar's feast, where the hand of God writes on the wall in the palace, "Mene, Mene, Tekel Upasin." And that evening, when Daniel explains what that all means, King Belshazzar actually meets his death. Now, Seven was telling me that particular story. Now, the reason why hers on my back stood up with that is because just before I left Sheffield, South Yorkshire, in order to meet with Miss Seven, I used to lead in a Bible study class, a small group, and the very last thing I led on was King Belshazzar's feast from Daniel 5 and the writing on the wall. So I felt that was a remarkable coincidence. And there are all sorts of circumstantial signs that I know I've had in this journey that prior to getting kicked out of the police force, where I was asked to make a stance in dreams without having any notion of what the New World Order was. So when the day came when I had my moment of decision on the fifth anniversary of the London bombings, when I woke up to 9/11 and 7/7 being inside jobs, it was the faith that gave me the courage, the faith through the circumstantial signs and the dreams it had. Now, none of that has abated since. It's continued. And I believe I've got a calling to help Miss Seven, because I believe Miss Seven's case is going to be immensely important in exposing the corrupt establishment. To have audio tapes for 3 days is unprecedented in the United Kingdom courts. And the extent to which it reveals and exposes the courtroom corruption at the highest levels and the abject failure of the Metropolitan Police to do anything about it is not to be scoffed at. I have sent this by email through all the European parliamentarians, all the parliamentarians in the UK, and the Truth Movement. And we're trying to get it out as fast as possible. So thank you very much in this instance for helping us in terms of getting the exposure out there. But I do believe it's immensely important. But
well, you know, here's the thing, Tony. I was reading one of my YouTube comments earlier before the show. Me out protesting or whatever. And he said that, you'll never have any effect going out there and talking and broadcasting and so on and so forth, so why bother at all? And, you know, to an extent, I can see what he's talking about, because you think to yourself, well, how many people will listen to the show? I mean, 10,000 tops? maybe up to 100,000 or something of that nature, off in some ethereal spacey land, listening to AM FM stations, which we can't measure. And I think about this, whether or not we're effective at exposing the truth by giving coverage to it, I think it's actually a misnomer and it's totally irrelevant. I think the whole point is just to do it, regardless of whether or not you're successful, because it's the right thing to do.
I agree entirely. We have got to be guided by each and every one of us by our own conscience. I mean, let's face it, we're confronted with it, utter evil all round. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil, for instance, as Burke would have it, was the good men to do nothing. And by good men, I mean women as well. So the evil part is to be, and what makes you complicit in this, is silence and burying your head in the sand. Each and every one of us are going to be answerable in one way or other. So it's a personal level. And I feel it's almost like I want to wake as many people up and tax their consciences. Whether they listen or not is entirely up to them. But if I feel as though I've been given a calling and been blessed to do that, then so be it. Whether it's not me that's going to make any difference. It will be in a higher power strength.
Here's another point. I also replied to this guy on the YouTube channel, right? And I said to him, look, mate, what you're doing is you're convincing yourself that doing something will accomplish nothing, and so then you choose to do nothing and accomplish exactly nothing. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, don't you get it, people? The more you, the less that you do, the less you accomplish. If you do something, even if it's not, like, ridiculously effective and change the world, at least you're not doing nothing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think most people now, a lot of people now are waking up to issues like 9/11. We no longer ridicule when we shout 9/11 was an inside job. We no longer ridicule when we shout the London bombings, the Madrid bombings were all inside jobs. And, you know, in more recent times, we've got everything that's happened with the Boston Marathon. All evidence pointing towards false flag operations. And people are becoming increasingly alert to it. But it matters not how many people are alert to it. It's not what you think, it's what you do and whether you take action or not. And there's far too many people who are thinking, well, it's somebody else's business. And in the midst of evil, they are simply too scared to oppose. But men and women become complicit in the evil they fail to oppose, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I feel guilty if I don't do a show every day and expose at least just a little bit of scumbaggery. Like, you know how some people, they feel guilty about their health? Like, if they don't get their exercise for the day or whatever, they start feeling bad about themselves. Like, oh, man, I really should have gone for that run. It's like that with exposing scumbaggery for me. You know, it's part of your daily exercise regime. And if you don't expose at least a little bit of scumbaggery every day, it's like you become lazy. It's like you become fat. It's like you become what you hate and despise. How can people live with themselves if they're not exposing scumbaggery? I just don't get it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'll just tell you this little one. One of the things that I said on the minutes before I was dismissed from South Yorkshire Police, and it was on the 2nd of September 2010 that was my dismissal hearing, I said, the police service are about to nobble the wrong Tony, and South Yorkshire Police are going to make at risk of making themselves complicit in the evil deed and countenance the perpetuation of the murder of hundreds and thousands of women, of innocent women and children in the Middle East. If they sacked me today, and they asked me who I meant by the rock, who's the other Tony then? And I said, well, isn't it obvious? It's Tony. I'm referring to Tony Blair, who was the chief architect on the war on terror, you know, which is utterly evil within, you know, grabbing our oil beneath their sand, so to speak, in the Middle East. It was all about resources, all done on the front of false pretense. So, by by doing it that way, when they sacked me, they were very respectful. They were very courteous. And they even thanked me and said I could be even useful to the police service. So the bottom line is here, I don't know what impact, if any, I'm having within the police service. I do know that the police chaplain at South Yorkshire Police had a quiet word with me and says, boy, you ain't half creating a ripple effect at ACPO level in the police. Now, what do I mean by ACPO? That's the high-ranking officers, the chief constables, the deputies and the assistant chief constables throughout the length and breadth of the country, where we've got 43 police forces in the United Kingdom. So, you know, stand up against evil and shout from the rooftops is my motto. As I say, I've tried my best to shout from the rooftops because I've gone up on the cliff tops of Frogger Edge with a megaphone and put it on camera and tried to make it amusing in the process. Some short, sharp bursts of how I confront South Yorkshire Police, how I confront the evil within. It's how I, you know, how best I can operate. I haven't got the gift of the gab quite like you. I don't think I'd make a radio broadcast there like you can, Vinny. But I've got an imagination that can make films, or, you know, with the help of filmmakers who know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I think that it's basically like you can do whatever you really want to, whatever tickles your fancy. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be born in as a multi-talented individual, so I can do radio, do music, do movies, write scripts and so on and so forth. You know, I can pretty much do whatever I like as long as it's some form of part to play in the entertainment game. But the ultimate thing is whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever you feel that you're capable of doing, just go ahead and do it, you know. It's like, I don't know. Everybody's got some kind of a calling that forces them, compels them to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it, it kills you. We'll be right back.
Bonkers.
In my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. And all I care about is sex and violence. And every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but unless sanity give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, the show that is just a little bit bonkers, and we get our thrills for free. And we also get Tony Farrell here for free as well. And here's another question I've got to ask you as well. What exactly is it about the police force? Because I think that it's like, when you get inducted into it, I know that you weren't actually a quote-unquote real police officer, but you must have seen the environment and how it works on people. And I've talked to a number of police, both male and female, of course, and it seems to be that the reason why good people go in is because they actually want to help people, they want to keep society in order. But there's also another section of people who go in there not because they're good people, but because they're real scumbags. And they actually want the power to abuse and hurt people. How do those people even stay in there? And more to the point, if those people are there, how do the good people justify staying in there themselves? You know, I just don't get it.
Well, I think you've got to look at the secrecy within the service, the hierarchical structure, and the extent to which people will go to in order to climb up that hierarchical rank to high places. Where, because of the structure, the hierarchy, it's incredible the amount of control that's imposed on the lower ranks. And police officers, by and large, are very courageous. They at the lower ranks, they're well-meaning, or they come in as well-meaning, and they want to do a good job. the vast majority of police officers, for instance, aren't particularly interested in climbing to the dizzy ranks of a chief constable or a deputy or even a chief commander. But what we get is that the courage that police officers have to display to protect life and limb, a 5'10" police officer would think nothing of bringing down a 6'6" thug who's actually committing a burglar or beating somebody up. They go in very dangerous situations without fear or favour, and they will come to the rescue of the public in those circumstances, by and large. However, the exact reverse seems to be true when police officers are called to stand up against the evil they might see within. And that because of the hierarchical structure, if a boss gives an order out, it's a question of, how high do you want me to jump, sir? When it comes to standing up against the orders from above, it's almost like they've got a sacred cow that they have to obey, and that any disobedience is something that they wouldn't contemplate, because I believe they tend to put their own reputation, their own welfare, first and foremost, and that they know if that any kind of act of insubordination with a service like that risks having them outing from the service in no uncertain terms, and they're not prepared to sacrifice their pension and their career for that purpose. So it's a case of, the survival of the fittest. These people who are hungry for power that come in there first, by and large, don't get the top for being, with one or two exceptions, don't get at the top of the organisation by being nice, friendly, decent, honourable people. You know, they will have had to have actually entertained some kind of skullduggery in order to actually climb up that ladder that is quite competitive at the expense of others. And common purpose training, which is a feature in the United Kingdom. I remember my last week in the police force before I actually knew I had to make the stance. And as a principal intelligence analyst, principal analysts were occasionally once or twice a year invited to conferences in which we'd meet up with our peers in other police forces. So we'd have a gathering for a day or two with fellow principal intelligence analysts in order to discuss the intelligence function within the national intelligence model of UK policing in law enforcement. And one of the things I noticed was that we were given insight and a day's tuition on the play, the Shakespearean play Julius Caesar. And it was put in terms of how we actually increase our sphere of influence. And the focus of that was not so much any kind of moral values. The focus of that was being as positioning yourself to use other people in order to climb the dizzy ranks and become as influential as you could possibly be, irrespective of moral standards. So gone was any kind of ethics. Gone was any kind of business ethics completely in the kind of tuition. Now, at the time, I didn't recognise this as a label as common purpose training. But I believe, looking back with hindsight now, that in essence was part of the unfolding common purpose agenda that has been rippling right through the United Kingdom public sector organisations. And we're not talking just the police, we're talking the judiciary, we're talking the public services and the National Health Service. And because of this common purpose training, which teaches you, encourages you to extend beyond your reach, extend beyond your normal boundaries and your remit to do work and business, this is now leading to power crazy people who are actually hell-bent on being part of this elite. And I think they're duped and they're fooled that it's going to serve them well in the long run. In the end, I believe it will be quite the reverse.
Kind of like a deal with the devil. You think you're getting everything you ever dreamed for, but the reality is you're losing everything that makes you you, and you wind up with nothing. that's the ultimate thing that people need to recognize. And I see this in gang culture of all kinds. I believe the police force also has a similar structure to gang culture, is that you've got to look up to the leader, you've got to do what he says. And eventually, you'll figure out, if you're a good person and you're onto it, that you really don't want to be part of this anymore, that it's not actually really going to provide you with a life worth living at the end of the day. And hopefully you can get off without being pulled back in the Godfather sense of the word. But in the police force, I mean, they can't force you to come back to the police force if you quit, right? It's not that kind of thing. It's more like the fear of leaving is what keeps people inside. Fear of losing their pension, losing their career, and so on and so forth. Well, I don't know about you, man, but I'm never going to put on a black uniform and bust into innocent people's houses and take them off to camps and what have you. That would be required of somebody in a position similar to that, maybe when the Shiite Muslim hits the fans, as it were. So I'd never be able to even contemplate going into the police force, because I know that that might wind up being a possibility someday. Others, it's kind of like a mixture of naivete, right? You go in and you believe the propaganda. We're the ones who keep order in the place. We're the ones who catch bad criminals. We're the ones who protect innocent people. The problem is, I see countless instances where the police are in fact not protecting the people, but more to the point, the very ones that prey on them. You ever notice that?
Yeah,
how the employment opportunity is basically the opposite of what its stated goal is. And this is the similar thing with many institutions, you know. Judiciary, what are you supposed to do? Oh, you're supposed to punish the guilty. Well, therefore, you're obviously supposed to let the guilty go and punish the innocent. If you're a police officer, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to protect the innocent and catch the guilty. So obviously, you're supposed to demonize the innocent and let the guilty parties go, and so on and so forth. Not like in a 100% this is exactly how it is type of thing, but in many cases, sure.
Yeah, there's institutional denial all around. And I know in the United Kingdom, many of the policies by police forces is that they will not ever investigate the judiciary and the legal establishment. So if they won't do that, they've got those sacred cows that are untouchable. And what we're seeing in the United Kingdom in particular here is that the emergence of the secret family courts, which are not just sort of stealing away young children away from families on the flimsiest of evidence, all based on foreigners coming over and giving expert witness statements that really don't hold up to scrutiny. The agenda seems to be to destroy the family, to destroy family values, and to make money through a utterly corrupt social services that has power beyond imagination. And that's what we're seeing as a movement within the United Kingdom. The secret courts are very dangerous. They're even jailing people in secret without a jury for the slightest sort of wrongdoing and a breach of a secret family court order. And this is a deeply worrying trend, and that the police are unwilling to do nothing. And I know my own police force, I know cases that they have been involved with, in particular the Vicky Hay case, which is an incredible case I won't have time to go into. But she's just been sent back to jail, given that her daughter was... the evidence against her daughter being... child abuse by a former partner was compelling, and in the end, instead of actually arresting and putting before the Crown Prosecution Service the merits of the case based on testimonies, what happens is Vicky Haig gets tricked, gets told to back down, and then when she backs down, she gets sent to jail for a breach of a non-molestation order, because the judge just slapped on her. Well, if you're changing your story, you're actually emotionally abusing your daughter. And she was tricked by her own legal team into that process. And now she's been sent back to a jail for a second time. And a more loving woman, a lady, a mother, you could not wish to find. So, and that comes back into my own backyard in South Yorkshire Police. It's incredible. There is one thing I did, which I'll tell you about. Last week, I sent an email to over 500 police officers in my own police service. And in that email, it opened up a link to one of the finest speeches I've heard about the. It was the chairperson of Everton Football Club. Everton Football Club sits side by side Liverpool Football Club in the city of Liverpool, two big clubs in the United Kingdom. And it was in relation to the Hillsborough disaster in 1989 that I've already spoken about. And in this speech by the chairman of Everton, he made an impassioned plea for justice and the truth in front of a packed-out stadium at Liverpool Anfield. And it was very emotional. I even wept when I heard that speech. And he opened it up with a passage from Philippians. So moved was I that I sliced and diced that speech and sent it with a nice covering letter through to South Yorkshire Police, who, for people that don't know, the disclosure issues are now coming to the fore, and that there is likely to be criminal investigation because at least 116 police officers have been found to change statements from back in 1989, and the whole thing has covered it up, or up until recent times. And sadly for me, all those emails got underneath the radar and hit every single police officer that I intended to do. And I thought this will hopefully touch the hearts and minds of the police officers who are not to blame for Hillsborough, but are operating within an organisation that is at, quite clearly, a moral crossroads. They have been found wanting, and their days are numbered if they don't actually change their ways. But you know what, Vinny? Only 12 individuals were willing to spend 6 minutes to look at that beautiful, scripted YouTube speech on a very momentous occasion and heartwarming occasion for a population who, for 24 years, have fought tooth and nail for justice. And it's a much maligned population, the families and the supporters of the 96 that died. And time again, they got pilloried by the media in the United Kingdom. But everything that they have done has been vindicated. And even now, even today, South Yorkshire Police are very loath to repent and come clean and declare what really happened and put these Liverpool supporters and the families who lost their loved ones out of their misery. All they want now, that they can't bring back their loved ones, but what they seek is truth, first and foremost. And then beyond truth, they seek justice in some way. And at the moment, we've not had a single police officer brought to book about the massive cover-up of Hillsborough. I myself have got my own theories about why they did Hillsborough.
Well, let's discuss that after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You know, to be honest, I'd never actually heard of the Hillsborough disaster, and after the break I want to actually discuss it a little bit more and inform me about what actually happened there. We'll be right back with Tony. We'll be right back with Tony Farrell, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday.
It's the final segment right here with Tony Farrell on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and he's going to enlighten me, and maybe quite likely enlighten the rest of you too, about what exactly the Hillsborough tragedy was.
Yes, Vinnie, it was the second year in succession that a football FA Cup semi-final was played between Nottingham Forest and Liverpool, and it was played at a neutral venue, which happened to be Hillsborough Sheffield. And the year before, in 1988, there were problems at the Leppings Lanes end, where people were reporting that they felt totally crushed. But the police never really took action upon that. Anyway, on the day itself, on the 15th of April 1989, Liverpool were given the Leppings Lane end again, the second time in succession, and there was a misprint on the tickets, deliberate otherwise, to get to the ground by 15 minutes to 3 o'clock kickoff. Now, there was only six turnstiles to funnel people through, so there was a mad rush outside the stadium and people were getting crushed. So a decision was made to open up the gate and let the Liverpool supporters in. Now, there were at the stadium itself, at the end, the Leppings Lane then was sectioned into three pens, but they all went through, a vast majority went through the middle pen. And that this was at a time when there was problems with football hooliganism in the United Kingdom, and it was all the stadiums were generally speaking all standing, or proportion was standing, and that all the crowd funneled through to the central stadium behind the goalposts, and because there was wire netting at the front, there was no overspill, and therefore people got crushed in the process, massively so, and it was horrific. And the police froze on the day and were very slow to pull the wiring down to allow escape over onto the pitch. In the end, 96 people were killed, crushed to death. And then there followed a massive campaign against the Liverpool supporters that they were drunk, they were urinating over police officers who were trying to give them help people kiss the life and resuscitate them. And all this was a fabrication put out by South Yorkshire Police senior management that was picked hold of by the mainstream media, in particular the Sun, Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper. And even today, the Sun newspaper is not purchased in Liverpool, so disgusted were they with the lies. And the death of the 96 was by and large covered up, and that South Yorkshire Police went to great lengths to distance themselves from any blame. Now, there were three inquiries. The most recent one, the Lord Justice Taylor, Stuart Smith, all showing evidence that the police changed statements, but it was as if, well, so what? And I believe, first and foremost, that in a way that was a deliberate sacrifice. And we have to examine qui bono, who benefits. Because what subsequently happened, and the first inquiry was Lord Justice Taylor's, it focused on the ground improvement on health and safety. But the effect it had was that it made Premiership football all-seater stadiums at a time when we were in recession. And now you've got a multi-billion pound industry in the Premiership football, which is probably the biggest sort of football league in the world at the moment, where a massive amount of money has poured in over the last decade. None of that would have happened under Margaret Thatcher's regime were it not for the fact that we had this disaster. Now, back to why it was all covered up, and why I know, for instance, even today it's still covered up, is because on the 20th anniversary, I wasn't really particularly attuned to Hillsborough as a principal intelligence analyst. It never came on my radar. But the press officer, Andy Hymas, sat with me in a canteen on the 20th anniversary looking completely shell-shocked. The reason why he was shell-shocked, he'd been in front of the chief constable that day facing the press on the 20th anniversary. And when he was sat with me over a lunch, he told me this story because he had been in working for South Yorkshire Police in the ground on the day itself of the disaster. And he told me that he'd been told to get to the control room, which had all the CCTV showing the horror unfold of people getting crushed to death, that was manned by police officers. When he made his way to the control room, they wouldn't let him in, the police officers, even though he was a member of South Yorkshire Police and a senior one at that. He was told in no uncertain terms when he relayed the message back to break the door down if he had to. He must get inside. And when he got inside, he realised why they were so reluctant to let him in the first place. It was because the highest ranking officer on the day, ACC Walter Jackson, was a gibbering wreck underneath the table and had lost the plot. Now, none of that came out in any disclosures. Even today, former ACC Assistant Chief Constable Walter Jackson is unblemished, untainted by the Hillsborough disaster, and yet he crumbled on the day for whatever reason. And the evil thing about that is that it's been covered up. And even after three inquiries, none of that has been exposed. And all those people in the control room would have had to put witness statements in. If they were truthful, they would have named and shamed Walter Jackson. But that never happened.
You know, this is something about politics that really frustrates me. Whenever they want something covered up or not viewed by the public, they will either conduct an investigation or appoint a commission. And the investigation and the commission are basically there to ensure that it's covered up.
That's right, yeah. And this is the one. This has gone on for 24 years, and it would have been dead and buried only for the fact that the tenacity shown by a single community in getting together, forcing the government to do something about this by way of petition, by way of incessant campaigning for the truth, that has overcome the evil within. And I was there. It was a privilege to be at the House of Commons debate in which the families were all there, and that the politicians, quickly playing up to the gallery, turned 180 degrees away from any blame attached to the Liverpool fans, but squarely laying the blame on the media, The Sun, Murdoch, and also South Yorkshire Police. That's entirely justified, given the cover-up. But it's very sad for me. I was a Liverpool supporter as a lad. I'm not particularly interested in football these days. But it was very sad for me to realise that my force that I'd worked for 17 years, had joined a service in 93, 4 years after Hillsborough, had covered all that up. Now, my story about Andy Hymas, he had no reason to tell me a lie on that 20th anniversary. I believe it to be true, exactly. But it was corroborated by another chap, a BBC radio, local radio reporter, a guy called Winston Cooper, who had the same story to tell about Walter Jackson. But on the 15th of April 2011... or 2012, I can't remember which now, he was murdered in France. So on the very anniversary, and allegedly it was his son that murdered him in a very vicious death. But that death, because Winston Cooper was the guy that spilled the beans in front of a colleague of mine, David Pidcock, who's the leader of the UK Islamic Party for Britain and resides in Sheffield and has been, together we've been very critical of South Yorkshire Police's role in Hillsborough. Winston Cooper, the guy that died, the father that died, we believe that his death was very suspicious because he had the power to expose this story of Walter Jackson.
That didn't by chance happen in a tunnel in Paris as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a film out there about Princess Diana, it contains damning evidence. But the establishment, the YouTube, they're all taking it down whenever but believe you me, all the evidence points to the fact that Princess Diana was whacked too, and it was deliberate. And we've
We've got only a minute or two left in the broadcast, and we have a caller on the line. I'd like to just quickly take that caller. We've got about 60 seconds or so. Colston, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Vinny. How are you?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous, man.
Good. Yeah, it's good to hear you. We haven't talked in a while. Anyway, fabulous show tonight. And the reason why I called was because my computer crapped out on me, and the only way I can listen is through the phone right now. But so I didn't have any general question. I just wanted to say it's a great show, and your guest is really enlightening us tonight. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Colston. Thank you for your call.
Keep up the good work, my friend.
Thank you very much, Colston. Thank
you. Take care.
All right. Well, that brings us pretty much to the end of the show then. Tony, we just want to quickly get out your website as well, the farrellreport.net. That's Farrell with two R's and two L's. The farrellreport.net. And thanks very much for your time, man. And anything you'd like to say in the last 30 seconds?
Well, just to thank you, Vinny, for the second opportunity I've had to appear on your wonderful show. I'm very grateful. And in terms of a final message, I just feel as though, I'll repeat that phrase, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. We all have a part to play in exposing the truth and winning the hearts and minds. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's basically my philosophy as well. You know, you don't have to do anything perfect or correctly or right or whatever. You know, just do what you feel is right and just don't do nothing. Because you know what's going to happen if you do nothing, right? Nothing! It's pretty straightforward. If you do something, something happens. You know, it's the nature of the universe. Physics, if you will, you know. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if you sit there and you don't take any actions, there ain't going to be any reactions. You know what I'm saying? I'm sick of people convincing themselves that it's a brilliant idea to sit around and do absolutely nothing and allow other people to do the fighting for them. It's stupid. It's lazy. It's inept. And it's frickin' scumbaggery at its worst, I think. You know, there's only one thing worse than a scumbag who tries to destroy people's lives and cover it up. And that's the scumbags who know that it's going on and choose to convince themselves to do nothing. This show is listener-supported. Please donate. Please subscribe. And we'll see you again sometime.